You're very smart today. Was it something I said?
Oh, thank you. I think you're talking about me and Patrick.
Well, you want to pass that we should stop wearing shirts that look smarter.
So I decided to just maintain a t-shirt. It's actually a good
Yes, well
way to
done.
find out that I don't have any suits in my wardrobe. So I'm glad this was the way that I found out. Anyway, guys, good
Is
morning.
it?
So it's looking good. It's looking good.
Well, I'm glad it still fits.
All right, guys. So today we're going to dive into a company that's just raised a 2.4 million euro pre-seed round. And they're based in London, which makes me proud as an avid Londoner. And they're tackling the value of real estate with electric charging, which sounds kind of strange, but we'll dive into that soon. We'll then discuss incubators towards the end of this episode. And welcome to Bricks and Bytes podcast with Patrick Hellerman, a weekly digest of the hottest construe tech news. But before we get started, on the subject of notes and smart clothes, Patrick, should venture capitalists wear shirts or smart clothes?
Morning, guys. Thanks again for having me. My answer to that is, like everything in life, it is gonna be audience dependent. So if I talk to a banker, perhaps. If I talk to a founder, perhaps not. That's how I'm approaching it.
Who is my audience today? Then I'm not
I don't
sure.
know, PV Herman.
Cool. All right, guys. So yeah, we're gonna discuss a company called Camion. Martin, what's the lowdown on Camion?
Yeah, so what I researched, Camion is a data-driven platform designed to identify and equip electrification-ready properties. And so they are building a platform to help real estate owners and investors electrify their portfolios at scale and get ahead of grid capacity constraints. So my understanding is that they want to help facilitate build of electrification network for the landlord so then they can supply and have their supply charging stations in their properties. Am I right or am I wrong, Patrick?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's okay. Camion is building something in a way that I think we've seen only very rarely. They go after fleet operators of large light commercial vehicle fleets. Think, for example, UK Postal Office having tons of vans. They typically rent their depots from a different landlord, and if they now want to electrify those fleets. It's a big trouble because you have to get approval from the landlord, you have to get approval from the grid operator, you have to get financing, and you have to purchase the hardware and organize the charging. So it's a very complex structure that Camion tries to solve.
Is it like too early? Is it not too early in the kind of cycle of electrification? Or maybe like, do you know where we are in terms of the current grid infrastructure or at the high level at least, and where we need to be to kind of not comply, but to get to the targets of net zero 250 kind of slogans, 2050 slogans, etc.
It's a great question. So if you, depending on who you ask, you will get numbers between 300 billion and 600 billion. Most people agree on like 450 to 500 billion that Europe needs to invest in its transmission and distribution grids in order to deal with, on the one hand side, the rise of intermittent energy, solar, renewables, solar, wind, and then in general, renewables. And on the other hand, more demand, especially from EVs. For example. And so that obviously is a huge sum that Europe would have to invest here in the next 7 to 8 years. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Do we know how much we do a year now?
I haven't researched that, but I'm very certain it's less than 10%.
Yeah.
Nice. Also, not because Europe doesn't have the money. Europe could scrape together the money if it needed to, although it requires political will to do so. But you're actually digging up streets, the transmission grids. That's a big effort already. The transmission grids are, think of it like the intercity grids for in a simplified way. The distribution grids, well, I mean, in Europe, they lay underground most of the time. Yeah. And so you're digging up roads, which makes it not just a CapEx problem. It actually becomes a very deep-seated operational problem to deal with that. And so where Camion sits, trying to help these owners of light commercial vehicle fleets, they sit in the cities or just outside of the city. So on the distribution grid. Mostly. And so in order to, let's say you need a fleet of, you want to electrify a fleet of 50 vans. That's a CapEx of about £3 million in the UK for the EV charging infrastructure. And the local grid operator, the DSO, would have to dig up the street and basically do its modifications, probably do something to the local transformer in order to allow you to draw that amount of power from the grid. Also, because these light commercial fleets, unfortunately, have to charge overnight because they drive over day. And so now you have 50 vans that need to charge overnight all at the same time, which is very, very bad. It's like the most suboptimal way you can.
That's interesting. But the good thing is that in the night, there's not that much of the energy usage, like from the residential part of community.
That is true, but there's also very little solar.
Yeah, exactly.
So something I mentioned in the introduction was this almost esoteric term. It says, tackling the value of real estate with electric charging. So I read that as, I'm a layman, by the way, and I read that as a increase in the value of the real estate asset by installing electric charging points within these assets. What do you guys think? Is this what Cameon are doing?
So I think before we give it to an expert, I can put my three things into it. So I think that the increase of the value is one thing, but on the other hand, the EV from the consumer point of view, I'm obviously not the business having a fleet of cars. From consumer point of view, the infrastructure is absolutely horrible right now. I've been having electric vehicle for the last 3 years.
Mike needs to get this off his chest. Come on.
Every like second charger I come across is either not working or when I try to pay, it just the charge is reversed and doesn't work. You need to upload an app, register, and then you can charge. And there's like 10 different operators in and around London. Then you need to have an account for, it's just a nightmare. So I think there is something to it. But the real theme I can see is like unification of the whole charging process. But that's obviously on the consumer level. For what Cameon does is probably slightly different. Well, it is different. Yeah, I just had to say what I said.
So I think for the real estate, that thesis is probably quite good for two reasons. One, it does kind of assume that the demand for commercial fleets for electrification will continue to rise. If it will not, then of course, the value of having access to charging overnight in a depot, it will not inflect that way. But I think it's a good assumption. Now, do I agree with the electrification? Let's save that for a different topic, but that's what the market believes it should be.
And they will be forced as well. Like, for example, London, you've got areas that you can't drive certain cars within, like, certain engine, right? So the businesses will be forced to move into electric, fully electric fleets for the smaller vehicles, definitely, because that's feasible, right?
That's the political will. So, and on the other hand, now that you have established, that assumption on the demand, which is probably a good assumption, getting these charging stations in place, unfortunately, is quite difficult. It's a very complex construct. Let me walk you through it, right? There's a landlord and there's a renter. The landlord is someone who owns the depot. That can be a large asset holding. That can be a small family, all colors. And the renter could be someone, like I said, the UK Postal Office or a grocery chain. And those two today have a very simple relationship. One provides the depot, the other pays the rent. But now if you introduce EV chargers, the next person introduced into this mix is the local grid operator, the DSO. Because the grid operator has to connect the EV chargers, has to probably make modifications to what's happening in the street and on the transformer level, and thus has to agree to making those changes and connecting your chargers. And again, if you're putting EV chargers for a fleet of 50 worth 3 million local capex, that's like a rat tail of investments on the grid operator. Now, the grid operator, unfortunately, has a long backlog of such requests. Yes. It's not like you're handing in your request and then within a week you get a response and within, let's say, 6 months you get connected. Not at all. This is a matter of months to years because of the backlog. And so that's one of the core theses that Cameon has is, hey, by actually doing a better workflow management of handing in the request for the EV connection and the grid expansion, by doing that workflow substantially better and automating the follow-ups of that, you will make sure that you're always at the top of the stack, right? Because your request is actually perfectly filled, it's been followed up with, etc. And I like that to a degree very much, because that's something that someone that only does like one request a year, they will not have routine, but Camion does. And you will actually have a wide array of different DSOs across the countries. In Germany alone, we have 800 grid operators. So in the UK, it's not 800, but it's still a large number. And so you will need locally your grid operator, you will need the local forms, the local processes, which Camion does. There's unfortunately another part that Camion will not be able to solve, and that is just how much processing time after you handed in a perfect application the grid operator will take. But at the very least, you will make sure you're always at the top of the stack. So now you've introduced the grid operator into this mix. You also need to procure hardware. So now you have an OEM or an EV charge point operator, either both or one of them that you need to decide for and procure from and set up contracts with. And you need a financer, because the landlord most likely is not going to finance it. And the fleet operator, because he's a renter, also perhaps would not like to lay out the capex in one go. So now you have a mix of actually five parties instead of two. And that's the mess. And Camion tries to bring structure into by setting up a more structured way to allow CapEx financing, to allow grid extension application for the EV charge point operations, to purchase the charging and to organize the charging.
Yeah. So in my understanding is the product, if I was to summarize what I think the product is here, is this suite of activities which will allow for charging infrastructure to be built, permitted, designed, permitted, developed, and operated.
Yep.
All right. Is there any better way of defining the product?
I mean, I would say the only piece that I think is very critical here is the financing as well. So finding access for the financing. And so I think one of the theses that two companies that are, they came earlier than Camion, and they did something similar, not exactly the same way that Jake and his team are thinking about it, who, by the way, are an awesome team. I can only recommend reaching out to them and talking to them. I'm very, very fascinated by this team. Raw and Humble are two companies that are sort of predecessors, different segments, slightly different approach, but they do share good commonalities. What's interesting that both of them got sold out after 2 years and 4 years to private equity companies. Mm-hmm. So that's the point, right? The core analogy, for example, that we had in our investment discussion was cell tower infrastructure. So cell tower infrastructure is a very popular PE play or an infrastructure PE play. Why? Well, because you can source a site, you can develop a site with the permitting from the landlord, and perhaps you need some local permissions. You can get the financing for it. And then once you put a cell tower on top and you make a rental contract with the mobile operator, you have 20 years of annuity. That thing requires very little maintenance. And now if you have a portfolio of 1,000 cell tower sites across the country, that's very, very investable for a PE. And so in EV charging operations, especially for light commercial fleets, I can see something similar being discussed.
That's interesting. So if I can steal one more on this. So from the landlord's point of view, how compelling is this case when I have to, they will build infrastructure within my premises and they own it. I don't own it. But at some point, let's say 10, 15 years from now, it will be very critical to have this infrastructure, because everyone, quote unquote, will have to be, driving electric fleets, right?
Electrified. So,
yeah. How compelling is it from landlord's point of view not to own this asset? Because at the end of the day, it's an asset, right?
So I think having the asset standing there is an absolute no-brainer, especially if I don't have to pay for it as a landlord. But your question is more complex. Your question is about whether the landlord would want to own it or not. I will say this to that. My quick anecdote from the Hellermann family. So my mother had a biomedical startup in the 90s and 2000s, sold it, got happy about after it, blah, 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 blah. And one of the things that she needed for it was like a big ass freezer in her offices, that like sink, a huge room that basically froze things to minus a lot of degrees. Mm-hmm. That thing was leased by a financer. So when the financer came after, I don't know, 10 years and said, hey, by the way, you will now have to pay us for taking over the freezer. You know what she told them? True story. She said, no, I don't want it. You can come and build it out. Take it out. Huh. What do you think happened?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, they left.
Nothing happened. So the freezer is still there.
Yeah, yeah, very good point.
So I think that's what's going to happen here too, and what the smart finances, of course, are going to factor into the equation.
Yeah, we mentioned. I think that my mic might be lagging slightly, so apologies. But you mentioned that they're a very interesting team. Something I noticed when I was looking Cameon up was the founder or one of the founding team. I didn't quite get that part. Was from Tesla. So I'm interested, Patrick, that. The PR companies in particular and maybe people on LinkedIn and their profiles and what make a song and dance about whether they've worked for one of these, let's say, big tech companies. So as an investor, does this add weight or is it a vanity metric?
No, it's a vanity metric in both of the cases. So it does make a difference. First of all, if you obviously co-founded or founded a successful company or semi-successful company, even a company that went through adversity, that does lend weight. That's clear. Your question is about, does it lend weight if I'm an employee of such? So if you're one of the first 10 hires of a highly successful company, you probably went through a rigorous vetting process. So that does lend some credibility to it. Let's take a closer look. If you were like the first hire in a new geography for a highly successful company that expands internationally, again, the company will probably have rigorously vetted you. But if you're the 100th employee in the headquarters of a highly successful company, unfortunately, the rule for almost all of the successful startups is that the quality on average goes down. There's only very, very few that will have been able to maintain a super high quality across, let's say, the first 500 to 1,000. Hires. There's some of them, but they are not the norm. They are the exception. So for me, that's not what excited me about Jake and his co-founders. What excited me is that they are all brilliant. They're all very good at sales and relationship management. And it's a very well-composed team. So Jake understands the EV side because he sold actually Tesla wall boxes, if I remember correctly, for Tesla in the US, in the Eastern US. That was his job. His co-founder knows grid.
And you said cold boxes? What was that?
Wall boxes. Tesla wall boxes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The consumer charging stations.
Yes.
His co-founder, she knows grid operations and grid connectivity. Mm-hmm. And the third co-founder comes from CBRE and knows how to deal with large institutional landlords. It's a very well-composed.
Yeah, very well-composed. Fine.
Yeah. So, sorry, guys. I am still here, by the way. My camera just couldn't bear the sight of your shirt and your blazer.
You're welcome.
It switched itself.
You're welcome. Yes. So what I like about this type of business, when we spoke already about a few in the last few episodes, is this one has clearly tailwinds of, on the website, they have some information like 7.5% of GDP will need to be spent on the infrastructure required to transition to net zero. Mm-hmm. £240 billion will need to be spent on EV charging infrastructure alone. Power demand is expected to increase by 2x between now and 2050. Obviously, these are headlines, and I like you smiling.
Don't lure me.
Oh, here we go.
But there are lots of tailwinds to this type of business. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the demand and the political will is there. Full stop.
Okay.
So we can we go on to incubators? I'm interested, also Patrick, on your opinion. So I was looking up a company this week, and what I also noticed about, I've been quite observant this week, haven't I, with the people that I've been dealing with.
Well, anyway,
I noticed that on LinkedIn, people have there's like a need that if you were in something like Techstars or Y Combinator to make sure that that's part of your LinkedIn bio. And then that got me thinking about the value again and weight of incubators. So within construction tech, there are a few that pop up that are run by, I suppose, other venture capital firms and investors in the space. And from your perspective, Patrick, you don't run an incubator as founder mentor, but what would your advice be to startups that are perhaps thinking of raising money Should they go to an incubator, or is an incubator kind of like a Hail Mary if you can't raise funds?
Okay, so for the sake of this discussion, let's make it oversimplification. Let's lump incubators and accelerators into the same class of things. They're not the same thing, but they do address a similar target group of founders. It's slightly different, you know, stages of the cycle, but both are exceptionally early and targeting founders who try to solve something similar. I do have from my past life some good experience with the acceleration side. I do know its troubles and its problems. And that's why personally I have no conviction if I'm going to found again to go there. They're just not going to give me what I need. However, I will make two exceptions to this. Accelerator concepts that would convince me to take a closer look. One, if I find an accelerator that is highly vertically specialized and that does not take extortionary terms from me. Unfortunately, the latter is very difficult to find. Yeah. The former is also very difficult to find. So, for example, if I were in health tech and I was a scientist that knows, you know, what I need to develop, that knows the chemistry or the biology behind what I'm about to develop, but I would like faster contact to 10 customers, and these customers are oligopolistic, and they're all organized in the accelerator program or having access to that. That's probably a good reason to give away that equity if the accelerator has excellent reputation, etc., and if they don't take ridiculously low valuations from me, like most of the accelerators out there unfortunately do, like 75,000 for X percent. That's completely ridiculous in most of the cases. Mm. And the other exception that I would make is if I'm a first-time founder and I'm really wanting to break into founding, but I have no way, I just don't have a network at all to connect with other co-founders, and platforms like EF, for example, or OnDeck, they would not describe themselves as accelerators. It's something that they would disagree with that they are, but I lump them together here for the sake of oversimplification. Can be a good place to be for someone that comes with that, let's say, how do you say, like starting disadvantage, right? Handicap, basically, like in golf terms. So in those two cases, that would perhaps make sense. Other than that, I have to say, I personally think that most accelerators and incubators, unfortunately, do not offer good deals for founders who otherwise would also make it big.
I think the question is like, who is funding these incubators, accelerators, and what's their incentive, really? Because I actually don't know who is funding usually those. Is it governmental organizations? Probably not. Is it private entities?
So there's probably a wide variety that you will find. I do know of some that are run by universities and probably financed by endowments or by well-wishers of the universities. Some are run by corporations, financed by corporations, and some are organized like funds, where that's probably the most common form, where external investors actually, you know, provide capital for the accelerator to deploy into the accelerator participants.
Yeah. So my feeling is that this is usually for founders who, what do I know again? It's for founders who can't bootstrap to revenue themselves and are not, I don't want to say good enough, but I will say that good enough to get venture funding. That's why it feels like the incubator accelerators seem to be a middle ground.
I would say in some cases, maybe, but.
Of course. Yeah. That's why I said disclaimer. What do I know?
I think accelerators are like a cut through society. You will find all kinds of high quality people, all kinds of personalities, etc. So the way you said it, Martin, is perhaps not how I would said it. But what I will say is that I think the hyper successful ones, or those that end up hyper successful, they would have been hyper successful without the accelerators.
That's right.
Very good. Okay, shall we wrap this up?
Let's do it.
I feel like I'm like the black box that just comes out with some noise every now and then. So apologies about the camera. Hey, Martin, what are you excited about this week?
Oh, next week. Well, I'm excited this week.
In the next 7 days.
I'm excited this week about next week, which is we're traveling to Berlin.
Who are you going to see there?
We're going to see Fundamentals to conduct some very good interviews with Fundamental team. And yeah, that's what I'm excited about.
Sounds
you good. Want to add something to it?
No, I just thought, oh shit, I better book my plane ticket. Hey, Patrick, how about you?
Yes, obviously meeting you guys in person. And then on Tuesday, I have a meeting with Robert Graebert, who is one of the owners and the CTO of Graebert Cat. And I've been waiting for that meeting for a long time to meet him because he's somewhat I don't know if I can say icon because he's perhaps too young to be
OG.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Like a person I respect a lot and I hear a lot of great things about, and so looking forward to that.
Brilliant.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you on to you. I'll see you Monday, Martin, and see Patrick on Tuesday.
See ya.
See ya.